together in a unique annual showcase.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2022. I'm here now with John Morgan. Now, John Morgan is a writer and editor associated with... Well, why don't you introduce yourself briefly? You were on last year, of course. Some people will remember you from that. I thought it was a really good episode last year. So welcome back and please introduce yourself.
Thank you. Well, yeah, I like to be on that. I always get invited here on the, it's the gold standard of live streaming in our circles these days. So,
Thank you very much.
I'm originally from the US. I'm currently in Hungary. I write and edit all over the place. I'm mostly a freelancer. People might remember me from years ago. I was editor in chief of Arcdos, for the first 6 or 7 years that it existed. I've written and edited for Countercurrents. I've spoken at a couple of American Renaissance conferences, and I can't even think of everything offhand. But yeah, I've worked with a lot of different outlets, so I've sort of been all over the place.
Right. Okay. Well, we're going to talk about the year's events, but specifically the Ukraine war and ramifications of that. So the Ukraine war is probably the single biggest thing that's happened this year. But so far on Millennial, I think this is the 10th stream that I've done so far, and so far it hasn't, the Ukraine war hasn't been sort of discussed in depth. So what would you say is going on here? Obviously, you have acquaintances, I think, on both sides of the war. What is happening here? What is this war?
Well, it's such a huge topic with so many aspects. That's a difficult question. But the first thing I have to comment, because it relates to the things we discussed last year, was I couldn't help but notice that it was literally. I was noticing that in the U.S. media, they were just starting to say in the mainstream media that, okay, COVID is over. Or not that it's over, but it's no longer a major threat. And it was literally within a few days that the war began on February 24th. And I don't want to say that I think there was collusion there, but I think it's clear that at least for the Western elites, this was a gift for them, because the sanctions and all the other economic fallout from this conflict are hitting on all the same major points that COVID was. But it's a lot easier to get people to shut down their businesses because they can't pay their utility bills in the name of freedom than it is to say, well, you've got to stay home because there's a deadly virus that's going to kill you and your family. So,
yes, this is one thing that's interesting about the Ukraine war is that it brings together what looked like two different elites. So you had the old sort of neocon Zionist warmongering sort of crowd. But they didn't seem to have anything to do with COVID. That seemed to be a different elite, which is Silicon Valley, the UN, World Health Organization, etc. But the Ukraine war seems to, well, as you say, it has the same effect on the West that COVID had, which is that it impoverishes us. It shuts down our industry and so on in a massive way. But we'll get to all that. But sorry to interrupt.
No, not at all. But while we get into this, you know, I'll make it clear off the bat that, you know, I am more sympathetic to Russia in this conflict for a number of reasons that we'll get into. But at the same time,
are you a Putin shill? Are you a Kremlin shill?
Yes, although I'm still waiting on the bank transfer, or the check, or however they're going
to pay me. Go ahead.
Well, you know, because when I was with Arctos, we put out the first English translations of Alexander Dugin. And I've been accused of being all sorts of things, but I over the years. But I think my favorite was when we started doing that. Somebody accused me of being a KGB agent. I think it was on Facebook, and I just wrote back and said, "Yes, I am a KGB agent. In fact, I'm the only one because the KGB was dissolved in 1991." but yeah, so
you're holding the line.
I
mean,
I really don't know why some people find it difficult to believe that there are people who are sympathetic to the Russian side, just, you know, based on their own analysis of the situation or the knowledge that they have, and draw different conclusions. But yeah, that is something that goes around. But what I wanted to clarify, though, was that I'm not somebody who thinks that Putin is the savior of Western civilization or anything like that. I mean,
I don't think that any serious people do. I mean, no one, like, you know, you can be sympathetic. You can understand Putin's motivations for doing this war without thinking that he's, you know, the God Emperor and he's going to save us all. I mean, it's absurd. And there are people who, I think, troll and they jokingly say things like that. I don't think anyone serious actually believes that.
Yeah, I've seen a few, but it's not serious people. I don't think any major thinkers or figures in our circles are saying that. But outside of Russia anyway. But for me, it's. I mean, you think about the fact that Putin is sending his army into battle, but they still have mandatory vaccination in the Russian military. The U.S. does as of now, but that will be ending soon because of the Republicans. They're forcing the U.S. military to give that up. They're fighting it, actually. The military brass wants to keep it going. But so, no, I don't have any illusions that Putin is some kind of heroic figure for us or anything. But I still think that if you value leaders, you know, like, say, Viktor Orban in Hungary, which I'm quite familiar with, Putin is basically Orban with nuclear weapons. I mean, yes, he's not, he doesn't check all the boxes in terms of what we want on the right, of course, but he certainly comes closer to the mark than anyone who we have in Western Europe or the US, you know, at least in major figures in politics. And also just the fact that I do think that the West having a counterbalance, not just with Russia, but China and Iran and Brazil. These are positive things, even if we don't see these countries as, like, you know, examples that we should follow, or that, you know, we want to be ruled by the Russians or the Chinese or whatever.
But I agree. And some people seem to object to this. I think what you're saying is it's good for the world. And correct me if I'm wrong. It's good for the world if DC is less powerful than it used to be. Therefore, it's good that there are rivals but to someone who is a sort of just wants the West to be the strongest thing, no matter how flawed it is, they just want that. That seems sacrilegious to say that. It's almost like treason to say that you want your own country to be less powerful than it is. I'm not going to name names, but there are people who have very controversial ideas, and yet, nonetheless, want America to be as powerful as possible, even though they're opposed to America, even though they don't like modern America, but they still want it to remain on top because it's their country. It's a strange. I can't really make this point without naming names. So I'm thinking about Richard Spencer here. Richard Spencer seems to have extremely unusual ideas, unfashionable ideas, at least in some departments. And yet he wants DC, America, to remain top dog. And I think he regards it as a sort of treason if someone supports Russia or is sympathetic to Russia in this kind of thing. But anyway,
which is funny because he was 8 years ago, he was going around attacking people who were insufficiently pro-Russian, you know, when the Maidan happened. And in fact, we had a few run-ins at the time over that, because ironically, at that time, I was saying that, well, we should give the Ukrainians a chance, see which way the revolution is going to go in and so forth. And he was on the pro-Russian side. So I don't really understand what he's doing these days, except he seems to be trying to prove to everyone that he's the opposite of everything he was 5 years ago.
Yes, yes. But I was only using him as an example. I don't want to get this to get sidetracked into talking about Richard Spencer.
No, I don't.
Because the topic of Russia and Ukraine is fascinating enough. So let's get to that then. I think we got into that because we were saying that it's good for there to be a multipolar world, basically, so that weakens the hegemony of what you might call the global American empire, Zionism, whatever. Do you want to take it from there?
Yeah, and I mean, we can already see this in action. I mean, if you think back to 2013, if you remember, there was that faked chemical weapons attack in Syria. And Washington, which was, you know, under Obama then, it was going to be bombs away basically any moment. And it was because Putin really put his foot down and said, no, you know, we're not going to tolerate this. He basically saved the Assad regime. I don't think Assad would still be there if it was not for Russian intervention. So and of course, it was really Syria working with Russia that really defeated ISIS. I mean, their contribution was much greater than anything that the U.S. or Western Europe did to fight ISIS.
There was a hint that ISIS, let's not get into that.
So that's a whole different thing.
So Russia and Ukraine, let's get back to that and explain your perspective of what has happened here. So I've forgotten where we got to that, but you just take it away.
Well, I mean, I was really surprised, I have to say, when the fighting actually started, because I was convinced that Putin was playing a long game, and that he thought that by putting pressure on Ukraine, he could either bring down the government or obtain regime change through some other way. You know, I've realized in the months since then that I've done more reading on this, and I think. Well, I still don't claim to understand what's in his head, but I think I understand at least the logic that he was following, although I don't think he had any illusions about the situation that he was getting into there, because here in Hungary, Orban gave an interview just a few weeks ago, because he went to visit Putin in Moscow just a couple of weeks before the special military operation, as they call it, started. And he was talking on Hungarian radio about this meeting and said that he asked Putin something about what he was going to do about Ukraine. And he said that Putin answered that, well, Ukraine has a very strong military now. It's been trained and equipped by NATO now for 8 years, so it's extremely dangerous. And you know, if they won't come to the table, then we have to, we're going to have to go in. And that kind of, for me, put the lie to the claim that, Putin had bad intelligence, or he thought that, you know, the war was going to be over in a few days. I mean, if Orban is accurate, and I don't know why he would lie about that, he knew exactly what he was getting into, but I think it shows the, depth of concern that he had about the situation, that he felt like he had to do it anyway.
Well, why don't you outline that situation so that people understand what is this thing that Putin was nervous about? What was going on?
Well, I think that they feel, Russians in general, feel a close connection to Ukraine. I mean, they have strong historical and cultural ties. So for them, I don't think it's like, you know, having a military base in Sweden or something like that. I think for them, the idea of Ukraine actually joining NATO and becoming part of the Western Alliance was sort of like a nightmare scenario for them. I know that you, when you had your discussion with Frody the other night, you said you don't like to compare the Cuban Missile Crisis. And of course, the situations are very different. But I think they're similar in that I think for Russia, Ukraine has the same gravity that Cuba had for the U.S. in 1962. Perhaps even more so, of course, because Cuba and the U.S. didn't have the strong cultural and historical ties that Russia and Ukraine have. But I just think that that for them was sort of like the final humiliation. And you also, most people only became aware of what was going on February 24th. But this had a long background. I mean, of course.
Well, exactly. That's what I'm asking about, because I think it's important to sketch the situation as it was and as it developed. I mean, what is the importance of Ukraine? What is, you know, go that far back, start that far back, if you wouldn't mind.
Well, Ukraine was always one of the most important of the Soviet republics, and of course of the Russian Empire before that. And a lot of the both Soviet and Russian leadership has had Ukrainian family ties and so forth. So it's difficult to, now we see them as locked in this extreme adversarial conflict. But I mean, I don't think that that's the way things always were. And I think maybe the Russians are surprised now by the depth of anger that there is there. But politically, this goes back to the 2000s. The Russians began putting forward their concerns about Ukraine and NATO even then. But there was never any serious attempt to bring it to a resolution.
But what were those concerns? I mean, I'm thinking that this is post-Cold War. So the end of history and all that. So then why would what is the concern that NATO and America would be using Ukraine to station weapons that could be used to hit Moscow? Is that correct?
Well, that's not, yeah, I mean, that's not just a paranoid fear, because, of course, American strategists like Brzezinski, who was the Secretary of State under Jimmy Carter in the 1970s, he was already writing in the 1970s about the idea that Ukraine could be split off from Russia, and then if they could actually put military bases there, that would be like, you know, checkmate as far as Moscow is concerned. So they aren't so crazy to have this idea. And of course, if you look at Russian history, it's the last couple of centuries have been the history of them being invaded and almost destroyed by the West. I mean, first they had Napoleon in the 19th century. Then in the 20th century, they had the Germans in World War I and then again in World War II. So for them, I think, they saw the 90s and the 2000s as a sort of interlude, but that sooner or later things were going to go back to how they typically are between the West and Russia. And in addition, I think Putin, of course, when he came in, had a very different leadership style and perspective than Yeltsin, who, you know, Yeltsin just wanted nothing but friendly relations with the West. Putin was the one who came in and sort of reasserted Russian identity, Russia's traditional role in the world. And I think he kind of made it clear to them that, well, you know, the days of just getting everything you want are over, which, you know, I remember watching that happen because I went to university in the 90s and I was always fascinated by Russian culture. I studied Russian literature and philosophy quite a bit at university in English. I don't speak Russian, unfortunately. But seeing the condition that the country was in the 90s was really horrifying. I mean, it was basically, you know, a combination sort of flea market, whorehouse. They were just being pushed around by the West. I mean, they didn't really have any ability to defend themselves. So seeing Putin bring them back from the brink, as it were, I found quite impressive. And I think the Russian people did for the most part, too. Like I knew Russians when I was living in the U.S. in the 2000s who I wouldn't even call them right wing or conservative, but they liked what Putin was doing just because he was restoring some sort of dignity to the country. And I think Ukraine for them, which has historically always been part of their sphere of influence, part of their empire, that is a special case for them. But even more specifically, you know, if we get to the Maidan, I mean, there's all sorts of things that happened even before the Maidan, but we'd be here all night if I tried to detail everything. But late 2013, early 2014, this protest against the government of Viktor Yanukovych broke out. And I actually went to Kiev at that time in January because I had a Ukrainian girlfriend at the time. And I also had some contacts among the Ukrainian nationalists through Arctos. There was a group, the Ukrainian Traditionalist Club, which was a big fan of Arctos books, and they got in touch with us to talk about having some of them sent to Ukraine for their groups. So I was friendly with these people, but I'd been living in India for 5 years. From between 2009 and 2013, I really wasn't up to speed on European politics. So I heard that my girlfriend suggested, let's go see what's going on, meet with our friends there. I thought, okay, that sounds great. I had really no idea what I was getting into. So I went there and I did meet with these people. I mean, some of them are people who are now quite prominent in the Ukrainian nationalist movement today. And they told me some really wonderful stories about, I'm sure you've heard about the intermarium concept, where their idea, so they told me, was that, well, if we can establish a strong Ukraine that has a real government that's answerable to the people, we can make a third way between, we don't have to go with Russia or with NATO and the EU. We can find our own way. And if we ally with the Baltic countries and the Central European countries and maybe even some of the Central Asian countries, we could have this third bloc and it would be dedicated to, genuine conservative right wing principles, values. And this sounded fantastic. I mean, in retrospect, it was extremely naive of me to even entertain this idea because it's simply not possible in Ukraine or anywhere in that region today. But it sounded good to me at the time. And I remember at one point we were walking through the Maidan, and which was being occupied by thousands of protesters. And they weren't all right wing. There were a lot of nationalists, but there were groups out there like kids who just wanted to be allowed to smoke pot and things like that. Like every group that had a beef with the government was out on the Maidan. And there had been some fights with the police the previous month, and they'd set up these barricades and there was sort of a truce when I was there. And it wasn't until the following month that things exploded again. And then that led to Yanukovych being taken down entirely. I did have the impression when I was there that there was a genuine grievance that the people had with the government. I don't think that that's all. Certainly the U.S. and the CIA were manipulating the situation. I mean, there's that phone call from Victoria Nuland where she's basically telling the Ukrainians who's going to be in the new government. I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a fact that's out there.
There's also that Tony Blair said at some point recently that he's been to Ukraine, I think, every year since 2010 or something like that. I forgot what it was. and this is the other side of things that I was hoping to cover, because Russia sees Ukraine as a vulnerable zone that it should rightly have influence over as part of that empire or historically. But then other powers have other interests in that same zone called Ukraine. Yes. So perhaps you could sketch that for us now.
Well, I think it's clear what the EU sees Ukraine as potentially. I mean, just like the US, they would really like to weaken Russia by taking Ukraine out of their orbit once and for all. But I think in addition, from the EU's perspective, I mean, Ukraine, I don't know if it's the worst economy in Europe, or it's certainly one of the poorest countries in Europe. And that's largely due to the corruption there. I mean, this government that we're backing is possibly the most corrupt government in, well, certainly in Europe, and probably one of the most corrupt in the world. So people who lionize Zelensky and all these things, that's just kind of laughable to me. But
well, we'll get to that. But I agree with you. I mean, I don't know how anyone can look at that man and think that he isn't in any way trustworthy.
No.
He reeks of corruption. And
besides the fact that when he was elected, that this is forgotten now, but he was elected on a platform of reaching an agreement with the Russians. He wasn't elected as, you know, the great anti-Russian crusader or anything. But I think the EU's objective is it'll be the ultimate cease of cheap labor for them. I mean, there's already a lot of Ukrainian workers in Poland, for example. And I think that that's if they actually get what they want, and Ukraine is ultimately integrated into the EU and NATO and so forth, I'm sure that that's what it would become for them, as well as a place to put factories. I mean, that's what Germany does with Hungary. One of the main pillars of the Hungarian economy is the German auto industry, because they keep a lot of their factories here. I'm sure the same thing would happen in Ukraine if it gets integrated into the EU. Right. But I just wanted to finish the story I was telling. So I was walking through the Maidan with some of these Ukrainian nationalists who I knew, and I saw there were people with, you saw tons of EU flags. I mean, they were everywhere. In fact, they were calling it the Euro Maidan, this protest, because it was, you know, the idea was that their aim was to join the EU. But I saw plenty of American flags and even Israeli flags. And I said to one of these people, I said, so you're telling me that most of these people agree with your idea of this intermarium, and they want this right wing revolution that will bring Ukraine on a third way? And they were all like, oh, yes, absolutely. Which I realize now was bogus. I don't know if they were lying to me or just they were deceived themselves. I remember I actually told them, I said, well, if it really comes down to a choice between going with the EU or going with Russia, I would go with Russia, because you have cultural ties with them. They're more conservative. I mean, they're far from perfect, but I think they would be better guardians of your ethnicity, your ethnic values or so forth, than the EU would be. And some of these guys agreed with me. I don't know. I'm not going to read too much into it. But then after the Maidan happened, I was briefly hopeful. I never made any public statements about it, because even then there was some uncertainty at the back of my mind. And, you know, like I said, because I really wasn't familiar with the politics at the time, I didn't understand the implications that this was going to have for Russia. So then there was the trade union house fire in Odessa. I think that was in May of 2014, where something like 60 ethnic Russians were burned to death by protesters in a building in Odessa. That was, you know, one of the events that really kicked off the wider fighting. By that point, then it became obvious to me that this was way beyond what I originally understood was going on there. And I sort of backed off and tried to maintain a more neutral stance after that point. In retrospect, though, I realize now that what the Russians were saying was absolutely correct at that time. So then things sort of settled down into this slow boil. With, you know, there was fighting in Donbass between the separatists and the Ukrainian army. And I kept mentioning to, you know, I was still in contact with some people in Ukraine at that time. And I said, well, you know, what happened to this Intermarium and this revolution you were going to have, and they would say, "Well, we're being forced to work with this liberal government for now, but you know, eventually we're going to have the second revolution, and that will be the right-wing revolution." But 8 years passed, and all I saw was more and more concessions being made to the West, more and more liberalization, and so on. So, I think that was just a pipe dream. But
yeah, it seems that bigger powers always had other ideas for Ukraine, and the idealists no doubt had utility for those other powers, but they were never going to get what they wanted. I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, because I know that there's a certain perspective in all of this, that Ukraine matters and the Ukrainian ethnicity matters and Ukrainian nationalists matter, their dreams matter. And, you know, in theory, yeah, these things should matter. And from a certain perspective, of course they do matter. But in the real world, geopolitics is a thing, and powers will do what they want with the materials of the physical world. It's building blocks for them. So,
but I don't think that, because the Russians initially... I think their demands were fairly reasonable. I mean, they weren't asking to actually annex the separatist republics initially. They just wanted them to be granted autonomy. They did want to keep Crimea, but I mean, I'm sure as you know, Crimea wasn't even part of Ukraine until the 1950s, and nobody's even exactly sure why it was given to Ukraine. But, where was I going with that?
Well, we were talking about bigger powers having ideas, having interests in the Ukraine.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I was going to say was in 2014. It might have been early 2015. That's when the new government in Kiev and Moscow signed the Minsk agreement, which was never implemented. And now there are officials in the Ukrainian government who have admitted that the only reason they had the discussions was to buy time, that they were never serious about actually implementing any of the protocols of this agreement. But if they had, then I think that we could have avoided this whole situation. But I think the whole time the government in Kiev had the US and maybe to a lesser extent Western Europe whispering in their ear and saying, no, keep going. You know, whatever happens, we're going to back you. So that's kind of how I see the situation having played out. And I personally, I certainly don't celebrate what's happening to the Ukrainians. Of course, we know war is terrible, but at the same time, I think they knew exactly what they were getting into, because there was this fellow in what's his name? I was just reading about him earlier today. Oleksiy. Just a moment, I'll bring up his name. Oleksiy Arestovich, who he was involved with the Ukrainian military in 2019, and he gave an interview to a Ukrainian journalist that's since been subtitled in English. What's interesting about it is that this journalist asks him about the situation with Russia. Now, this was in 2019. And he says, well, probably around 2021 or 2022, things are going to reach a breaking point, and then there's actually Russia's going to attack. And he outlines what will happen after that. And it's basically a capsule summary of everything that has happened the last 8 or 9 months. And then at the end of it, he says, and this is the best outcome for Ukraine. And the journalist kind of reacts, you know, surprised, saying, well, you know, how is that a good outcome for Ukraine? And he says, well, you know, once they do these things, the EU will have no choice but to take us in, and NATO will have no choice but to take us in. This video is online. This guy is now he's an advisor to Zelensky in his office. And he's actually talking about running for president after Zelensky. Interestingly enough, he was also involved with Dugin's Eurasia movement many years ago. But that's maybe that's another tangent.
Yeah, yeah, so, yeah. But so what you've said what Russia's interest is in Ukraine, the EU's interest, but what about America's interest? What why is America invested in all of this?
Well, the real target of this for the U.S. is not Ukraine. I mean, I think they're very happy to try to take Ukraine out of Russia's orbit. But if you look at the history of the last 150 years, what Britain has always wanted to do, and then America, once America displaced Britain, their greatest fear has been, or one of them, has been for Moscow and Berlin to get together. And that's exactly what was about to happen. I mean, with the new Nord Stream pipeline, Germany, and which, of course, Germany is the heart of the EU. The EU was getting into a position where by working with Russia, they could think about getting free of U.S. domination, both economically and militarily. So I think from the U.S. perspective, this whole thing was about splitting Germany off from Russia and, to a larger extent, the EU itself. And I mean, I'm sure they're ecstatic now at what's going on. I mean, there's talk of, you know, U.S. gas and oil being bought at exorbitant prices in Europe. NATO's been bolstered and so forth. So I think that they're quite happy with this outcome. This isn't confirmed, but did you see that Rand Corporation document that was allegedly leaked, dated from January?
Yes, I did, but I've forgotten what was in it now. It rings a bell, but I've forgotten what it was. Yeah, go on.
Well, it purports to be a plan put forth by the Rand Corporation.
Oh, yes, this was to bankrupt Europe.
Yes, by goading Europe into a conflict with Russia in Ukraine.
Yes.
So we'll never know for sure if it's authentic, although my own feeling is that it probably is. But even if it isn't, it's like still...
The protocols of the elders of Rand.
Well, exactly. I mean, what Julius Evola said about the protocols was that, well, it doesn't actually matter if they're authentic because they nevertheless accurately describe what's happening. And that's just how I feel about that document.
Yeah.
Even if it isn't real, it portrays the inner essence of what's going on here from the U.S. perspective. So that, I think, is the U.S.'s main interest in this. I mean, the prize for them is to split Berlin off from Moscow, which is why I didn't really think that that's what Putin wanted to do at first. But there's, I don't know if you've ever heard of, I'm blanking on his name. Valery Morozov.
No, I haven't heard of him.
He's on GB News sometimes. But he's a former Kremlin official under Putin, and he blew the whistle on some corruption around the Sochi Olympics, and he had to flee, and he lives in the UK now, and he's like a Russian analyst. And he's on GB News. He also has his own website, and he's on social media. I like following him because he very much has the perspective of a Kremlin insider. But he talks about the things that maybe they don't want, you know, that Putin and his entourage are not going to openly talk about. And he was saying at the time that the war started that, well, you know, Putin and Russia, they've basically given up on the West and now they want to turn eastward because they see Europe and the U.S. are basically in a state of collapse. And you know, Russia has always seen itself as a separate civilization. They don't see themselves as part of the West per se, or at least not the more conservative ones like Putin. So it's too early to say what the outcome of this strategy would be. But my own hope is that maybe if they get cut off from the West, maybe they can become something new, something more traditional. This may also be naive. I don't know. We'll see how it plays out. But I would like to think that Russia has the chance to become something better than just becoming westernized like everybody else.
Of course. But I guess the thinking from the American side was that Russia couldn't possibly win this. What do you think, what's your perspective on this? What were the Americans, the Pentagon, what were they thinking would happen if they keep encouraging Ukraine, goad Putin into invading, what were they? What did they think was would play out?
Well, I think that they probably suspected what was going to go down. Although I'm not completely sure, because even the CIA and other institutes in Washington were saying that well, the war will be over in a few days. I mean, I don't know if that's what they really believed. Maybe that's just what they said publicly. But maybe even they were taken by surprise by how well the Ukrainians managed to withstand the attack. Although, I mean, they again, I think a lot of people in the West think that this just started in February, whereas the Ukrainian military had been being trained and equipped by NATO for 8 years by that point. So I think that they were effectively a NATO force already.
Well, I mean, this is this is a big part of it, that Ukraine, it seems that Ukraine has been sort of groomed by the West for a long time. I mean, 8 years. And then there's also the installation of Zelensky as the prime minister. I mean, what would you say to that, that Ukraine was sort of taken out of the hands of the Ukrainians in a way?
That could be. I mean, I haven't studied Ukrainian, you know, domestic politics in depth over the last 8 years, but I mean, my own feeling, for example, when the people I used to know among the Ukrainian nationalists there who were telling me about this second revolution. Well, there were two elections in Ukraine after the Maidan. There was one in 2014 and one in 2019. But if you look at the combined results for the radical right-wing parties there, it was in the low single digits. So that doesn't suggest to me that the Ukrainians actually want, you know, some kind of great ethno-state or right-wing revolution. I think
they're probably blinded by the idea of Western wealth. And
of course, like everywhere else in Eastern Europe, including Hungary, they were blinded by the idea that, well, we get integrated into the EU and NATO, and then we'll be rich. And, I don't think they're thinking beyond that. I think they just have their eyes on that. This is why countries like Poland and Hungary are now, have kind of grown sour on that vision, because that's kind of what led them into the EU. Now they realize that it's not all what it's cracked up to be.
Indeed.
I think the same would happen in Ukraine.
I should say, I mistakenly said prime minister. Zelensky is not the prime minister. He's the president of Ukraine.
Yes.
I thought while I was saying that, that's not correct. And I've just checked and it's not. What I was getting to there is the idea that it has been groomed, the idea that it's been reshaped, in a sense, precisely so that this war would happen. Do you think that there are interests in the world, Zionist, that have a specific interest in Ukraine? I'm not even sure if there are. It just seems that it is a heavily... There seem to be a lot of Jews involved in Ukraine, including Zelensky himself. But I'm not saying that he's some sort of mastermind. I suspect he's largely a puppet. But what would you say about this angle of it?
Well, I haven't really looked into that angle of it so much, but I do remember that earlier this year, Greg Johnson had a debate with E. Michael Jones. And Jones was really focused on that aspect of it. And he was talking about all the historical ties that the Zionists had in Ukraine going back to the 19th century and how important they see Ukraine. I really need to look into that more. I haven't really delved into that aspect of it, but there might be something there as well. But I see plenty of other forces at work there beyond that that explain the current situation. As is well known, I mean, the Jewish oligarchs in Ukraine are quite powerful, but they are in Russia as well. So I don't know that we can really say that this is one side or the other is anti-Zionist per se. But
no, and I wasn't trying to make that case. I was just curious about what you thought about this angle of it. Because as I say, it does seem that there are a lot of Jewish actors... actors, musicians, comedians involved in this both within Ukraine and in America. So I was curious about that, because I did hear at some point that a term, I think it was greater, like a new Israel. I think Zelensky said at some point that it would be like a new Israel.
Yes, he said after their victory, they would be like a new big Israel or something like that.
But I think what he meant was that it'll be a high security state, because in the way that Israel is. So you've got to have men with machine guns at the supermarket and stuff like that, because otherwise the Palestinians could wreak havoc. And in a similar way, the Russians could wreak havoc. So it's going to be a state that needs constant, well, a police state, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I think whatever the outcome of this conflict is, that's probably going to be the result, because I don't want to speculate, because when I look at news about the military aspect of the war, I don't know who to believe. Because if you go to the Western sources, they claim that the Russian resistance has been a farce, and it's useless, and that they're going to collapse any day. But then if you go look at the pro-Russian sources, they're basically saying the same thing for their side.
Yes, it's really annoying. And what's also annoying is how people choose which side they want to believe based on what they want to be true. So the people who hate Russia will say, well, obviously Russia can't possibly win this war. It doesn't even need
they're
to
still
say.
Holding a lot of territory. So obvious.
Yeah, and then the other side will say, well, Ukraine doesn't stand a chance. Let's face it. Let's be honest. Come on. I mean, it's very annoying. I wish people were more, more honest about this. But it's, as you say, it would be very hard to get genuine military data out of it from either side.
Yeah, and I mean, these days, half of a war at least is propaganda. I mean, if you remember when Trump bombed Syria the first time, it was because he said he saw that photo of the beautiful dead babies on the beach. So that's what induced him to give the order. So these things are, all these conflicts now exist half in virtual space, if not more. But I don't believe Russia didn't take Kyiv. They haven't swept across the country in a blitzkrieg, but at the same time, considering what they're up against, I think they've done pretty well. I mean, they're still holding on to a lot of territory. And considering that Ukraine, I mean, they're practically fighting the U.S. military. In fact, maybe better than the U.S. military, because I would think the Ukrainian troops are probably in better shape than most of the Americans.
Well, and they have a vested, and they have a vested interest, because it is their land that they're defending. So,
right,
perhaps American troops would be less, committed to the fight, as it were.
Well, there probably aren't too many transgender Ukrainian troops yet. Yeah.
No, not yet. Zelensky will see to it, though. Well, so what do you think in terms of the repercussions? What are the long-term effects of all of this? I mean, I think the main one, obviously, is... In fact, I'll let you answer that. What do you think? I mean, how is the world different now than it was a year ago because of this war?
Well, it's very different, of course. For Russia and Ukraine, I think ultimately they're both going to be unsatisfied. I mean, I don't see any way that Russia is ever going to give up all of the territory that they've gained, and I don't think they're going to have to militarily. So the Ukrainians will have to make some concessions, but also I think Russia is going to have to settle for the fact that they're going to have a hostile regime in Kyiv, probably, no matter what they do. But I think the worst of all is for Europe, just because I, like many people on the right, really dreamed that by Europe teaming up more with Russia, maybe that could finally get Europe out of the American yoke, as it were. And that, that's off the table now for at least, I would say, the next decade, maybe longer. And by then, who knows if there'll even still be a Europe that's identifiable. So I think in that sense, it's quite bad. But I the U.S., of course, is very happy. This is all very good for America. And as I know from talking to people back home, a lot of America, I don't even think it's as big of a story there as it used to be. So people are already forgetting about it. I mean, I guess there's always the nuclear wild card. What I always tell people is I think it's unlikely, not impossible, that it could go nuclear. But well, I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. So far, the Russian side seem to have been quite cautious, conservative about how they fought the war. They don't seem to have gone hell for leather. And they, as far as I know, haven't used any anything approaching nuclear weaponry.
No.
I think I heard at one point they were thinking about using some sort of torpedo that had a certain nuclear element. I can't remember. The point is, I think Russia could have gone, could have been much more aggressive. But I think they wanted to, I think they didn't want to look terrible, actually. I think they didn't want to do, to be vastly more destructive than they absolutely needed to be. That's the impression that I've had really from the start. I think they probably, again, I don't know anything about the actual territory. I'm certainly not a military strategist, but it seems to me as a layman that if that Russia does have the materiel and resources to have won this war quite a long time ago, but they just didn't want to be seen as genocidal maniacs.
That's possible. I don't really know because, you know, I would have to have information that only, you know, intelligence services have access to. I kind of regret it now, but I published an article about 2 weeks before the invasion started in February where I said that, well, Putin won't. I gave all the reasons why I didn't think Putin was going to take military action. And the main one was I said, well, he doesn't have enough troops. And I think that was actually, I think I was actually right. But yeah, that, so I don't know. I mean, Dugin himself, who, you know, I know Alexander Dugin, I've worked with him several times over the years. He was saying in 2014, you know, that, well, we have to go in now. We have to go all the way to Kiev. And even in Russia, you know, a lot of people were saying, well, you're completely insane. He probably lost his position at Moscow State University for saying that. Well, as well as some other things he said at the time. But he was probably right. I don't, if they had done it in 2014, maybe it would have gone as well as they had hoped initially. But I think even they were probably surprised by the depth of anti-Russian feeling there. I have to say, even in February, I never had any doubt that there would still be an identifiable Ukraine at the end of this, because my ex-girlfriend, who I mentioned before, you know, she's a Western Ukrainian. Her family is from the Lviv area. And those people really despise Russia. And I didn't think that Putin would ever try to go into Western Ukraine, because it's almost, I mean, first of all, they're Catholic there. They're not Orthodox. They speak Ukrainian. Even in Kiev, you know, most people speak Russian, or they did. I know this was 8 years ago that I was there. My idea was I thought he would try to split off the western part, the western and the eastern part of the country, and maybe there would still be a Ukraine in the east for the ones of the more purely Ukrainian ethnos, and he would try to take as much of the eastern part as he could. And that may still be a strategy, but it, you know, he's obviously, well, it's unlikely, I'll say, that he's going to get to Kiev, or, but who knows? Again, I don't like to talk about the military side because I think it's so unclear.
Yeah. Yeah. And you and I aren't military strategists. We don't, it's not our wheelhouse. One other thing that's related to all of this is obviously the Nord Stream pipeline bombing. Or spontaneous explosions that happened, I think, in September. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear what was going on there. I mean, for me, I don't know that it was necessarily the United States that pulled the trigger, as it were. I mean, they may have worked through some proxy service, like maybe the British, or, you know, who knows, maybe the Poles, I don't know. But I think it's pretty clear what was going on there. I mean, we have that statement from Biden from months ago where, you know, he said they were essentially said that's what they were going to do. And of course, there's that, you probably know more about this than me. Wasn't there that weird tweet from, or I don't remember.
Liz Truss. It's probably the, it's amazing that her premiership happened to, it was so short, but within it, something significant did happen. And yeah, she said something like, it is done. I think it was an email that she sent to America. I can't remember now. If that is true, then it would look like it was the Royal Navy who did it under the direction or at the request of the Americans. Or it was the Americans who did it themselves, and that email was referring to something completely different. Who knows? But yeah, it does definitely seem to me that this was America who did this. You said earlier that it was to keep Germany and Russia separated. I didn't actually think of that. I thought that the reason that they were assuming that it was America who did it, I assumed that the reason they did it was to prevent Germany from having a motivation to leave the war effort. What would you say about that?
Because, why would you think that would be because if the pipeline's already destroyed, that effectively removes the, excuse me, I just realized I need to plug in my laptop. So,
all right. Okay. Take care of that. We don't want you to disappear. Because Germany was supporting the war effort for Ukraine, so the fact that it was getting gas from Russia could obviously be could motivate Germany to pull out of supporting Ukraine.
Yes, of course.
So yeah, that was why I thought America removed that, it bombed the pipeline so that Germany is no longer getting gas from Russia, therefore it no longer has a reason to pull out of the war effort.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. I mean, I was referring to why the U.S. engineered this situation to begin with. I mean, going back to, you know, even before this year, that I think maybe the main goal, certainly one of the main goals, was to split Berlin off from Moscow. But I think that the bombing was just like one more nail in the coffin. It was like, no, there's no going back now. I mean, Germany was was getting quite friendly with Russia before February. I mean, I've actually, I'm in Budapest right now, and there's a lot of German tourists here, and I speak to them, and even ones who are not, right wingers or whatever, all say to me that, you know, what a catastrophe this is for Germany, and they don't understand why their government is, you know, suddenly so pro-Ukrainian, because it's really in their interest to get with Russia. I think there was a widespread sentiment there. And like I said before, I mean, this is going back to the birth of the German Empire in the 1870s. Britain and America have always feared Germany and Russia getting together. I mean, they only ever did it briefly in between 1939 and 41. Then the Germans actually broke it. Yeah, that's, if you look at geopolitics over the last century and a half, that's always been a main goal for the Anglosphere, is to keep Russia and Germany separate, because that would be quite a formidable combination. And they also, Germany is, of course, not very conservative these days, but the idea was always that, Thomas Mann, the novelist, there's a book he wrote at the time of the First World War that's kind of forgotten now, called Confessions or Reflections of a Non-Political Man. And he talks about all the commonalities that Russians and Germans have together. And one of them, he says, is that they're both inherently conservative in their mentality, and that their mentality is very different from, say, the French or the English. And he thought it was the destiny of the Russians and the Germans to get together, sort of have like a, you call it like a conservative alliance, as it were. So, I read that book many years ago, and I think that maybe that dream has remained on the minds of people in Moscow and Berlin even today, which is why I thought it would be a good thing for that to finally come to fruition. But Yeah, I don't know. I I guess we have to say that the death of the unipolar world has been greatly exaggerated, at least so far.
Well, indeed, because especially with the destruction of Nord Stream, because no one seems to know yet. I mean, it's like it's like something that's happened. It's so massive that the ramifications of it are going to take a while to sink in. It seems. I might be laying on a bit thick there. I'm not sure, but it seems to be. I mean, I've heard talk of that Germany is going to deindustrialize. What does that even mean? I mean, that sounds incredible.
Yeah,
that sounds absolutely. The industrial powerhouse of Europe is going to deindustrialize. What does a deindustrialized Germany look like? Is everyone working in call centers? Is everyone working on the land? Is it agrarian? What is it?
It sounds kind of like the Morgenthau plan, doesn't it?
Yes, indeed. From
the end of World War II. I think that was the goal, a deindustrialized Germany.
Yeah, exactly, which is ominous. So it seems that this is going to, as the effects of it take hold, it could just destroy Germany as we know it, and therefore Europe as we know it.
For sure,
because it all rests on a steady, cheap energy supply. If it doesn't have that, then you cannot have the First World. So that would indeed, going with the Rand Corporation, possibly apocryphal memo, that would have the effect that the First World would be limited to America.
Well, that's always the goal of Washington. I mean, I'm American myself, so I I know Americans always want to see themselves as the supreme power, because it's just in our national DNA, to think that we're sort of like the anointed nation to lead the world in the ways of freedom and democracy. I mean, I think people in Washington and New York and Wall Street and so forth have more sinister motives, but that's the feeling that they play on. But I hesitate to say, because I agree with you, it's a disaster. I just don't know where it's going to end. We have to see how well Europe is able to cope with the situation. I mean, they're looking desperately for alternative energy sources now, other ways of getting gas and oil. I actually attended a talk a couple of months ago here in Budapest, where there were some executives from the Hungarian energy industry who were speaking about the situation. And it was a talk in English, so I could follow everything. And basically what they were saying, well, as you probably know, Hungary has taken a very strict neutral position in this war. So in that, they're quite unique within NATO and the European Union, since they're a member of both. But I appreciate seeing what the Hungarians have to say about the situation, because even though geopolitically they're virtually insignificant, they have a unique ability to kind of step back and look at things objectively. So what these executives said was that, it might be possible for Europe to figure out one of them said that he thought that the sanctions would end up having so many loopholes and exceptions that they would be basically worthless. He thought that Europe is just going to start buying gas and so forth from India or whatever, where they get it from Russia, send it through Indian tanks, and then it becomes Indian gas, and then they can sell it to Europe without breaking any sanctions.
Or Israeli gas as well. I heard the same thing.
I'm sure they'll get it from every source they can.
Yeah.
But the other fellow is saying, well, we'll find solutions for that. But he said the real problem will be petroleum products, because, of course, petroleum goes into everything. I mean, even our laptops are made. I forget how many gallons of petroleum goes into the making of a laptop. But he said that is something that there isn't going to be any easy replacement for. And he said even within the next 10 years, that's not going to be possible. So he thought that eventually they would have to reach some new understanding with Russia. But
Wow. It seems incredible. I mean, I guess as you're suggesting, we're just going to have to wait and see, because it's such a huge thing. It's impossible to predict how it will play out. Okay, there are two super chats here, both from Winston. And he says, and this was a few minutes ago, I think he might have missed the start of our talk. He said, what do you make of people suggesting that if Ukraine is successful in the war, the Azov battalion will succeed Zelensky as being the new leaders of Ukraine? If this is the case, why do a lot of white nationalists in the West still support Russia?
Well, I really don't think, you know, I was talking earlier about how the Ukrainian nationalists I knew there were telling me in 2014 that there was going to be this second revolution, and some of them ended up getting involved with Azov later. Didn't exist in 2014 yet, or at least not in the beginning of 2014. First of all, I think they would have already done it if they wanted to. I knew, I don't know if you've ever heard of Manuel Ochsenreiter.
No.
He passed away a year or two ago. He was a German journalist who ran a magazine called Zuerst. And he was a right winger, but he was very pro-Russian. And I knew him. I met him a few times. And I remember we met in 2015, and he said to me, well, if at that time it was right sector, Azov hadn't become that big yet. Everyone was talking about right sector. And he said, well, if right sector was really serious about this second revolution, they said all the Ukrainian forces are in the east now fighting the separatists. He said there's nothing in Kiev. So if they were really serious about it, why would they be spending their time fighting the separatists? Why wouldn't they just go to Kiev and overthrow the government, which would be very easy? And I don't have any answer to that. I mean, the obvious one is that they didn't want to do that. So I don't even know that that's necessarily their goal. But even beyond that, another analogy I think of was in the 1990s, I was first getting interested in nationalism. I wasn't like active like I became later, but I knew nationalists. I started talking to people. At that time in the 90s, everyone was excited about the Croatian nationalists that were, of course, fighting the Serbs in the 90s. And what I kept hearing from people was that, well, you know, we have these hardcore right-wing guys, and they're getting all this military experience. And after the war, you'll see they're gonna take over Croatia and basically turn it into the Fourth Reich. Well, I mean, they were given a lot of resources and during the fighting, they did what NATO wanted them to do. Then once the war ended, all those people were sidelined and kept out of power. And now today, I mean, Croatia is not even as conservative as Hungary. It's certainly no kind of bastion of right-wing values. So I think the same exact thing would happen in Ukraine. I think they would, even if whatever victory means, if they win as they want to, I don't think that they would ever be the ones with their hands on power, because they're going to be indebted to the U.S. and the EU and the West more generally for the next 50 years at least. And you're not going to convince me that they're not going to make sure that if people who they like are the ones who end up in power. I mean, it's like that conversation I mentioned before of Victoria Nuland, you know, telling the Ukrainians, you know, who was and was not acceptable in leadership positions in the new government after the Maidan. I mean, all those same things are going on now. So I really don't believe that that's going to happen. And I think even if they did, then you would suddenly hear Washington and London and Berlin saying, well, you know, Ukraine has turned on us. You know, it's like the Taliban. You know, now we've got to go to war with them. And then they'll bring out the banner of democracy and freedom again and say, we have to liberate the, I mean, they'll probably use Putin's rhetoric. We have to liberate the, we have to liberate Ukraine from the Nazis. I'm sure they would, you know, well, we have the people. We had the Democrats and we had the Nazis. The problem is we gave the Nazis too much power. So now we have to fix the situation. They would never allow those people to take over. I'm quite sure.
Yeah, that's my thinking as well. It simply wouldn't be allowed to happen. There are forces more powerful than them who will stop them from getting what they want. Unfortunately, and I wish it weren't, I really wish that weren't the case. It just seems to me naive to think that it's not the case. That unfortunately, it really is rotten. It's a rotten thing to say. You know, I wish that the Ukrainian nationalists who care about Ukraine and the Ukrainian people and all that, I wish that they had the power to take their country and take care of their people. Ideally, that would be the situation. But unfortunately, in this world, that doesn't seem to be the situation.
I don't know if that's what they think they're doing or if that's just what they say. I mean, I've certainly talked to Ukrainians who claim that that's what they want. But I have to say that not the people who I knew, but if you look at the actions of the Ukrainian government, I think one thing that's important for people to understand is that when the Russians talk about the Ukrainians being Nazis, they're not using it in the same sense that we do. But the post-Maidan government has been extremely chauvinistic in terms of the Ukrainian ethnos, because Ukraine, just like Russia, has a lot of ethnic minorities. There's Subcarpathia, which is used to be part of Hungary until 1920. The Allies gave it to Czechoslovakia. Then Stalin, for whatever reason, gave it to Ukraine in 1946. So now it's part of the sacred soil of Ukraine since 1946. But there's still hundreds of thousands of Hungarians living there. And there's a documentary online you can see about the harassment that they've been subjected to since 2014 by the new government. And this is besides all the actions that the post-Maidan government took against ethnic Russians, and which they're still doing. I mean, like Zelensky's, he's going after the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine now. And there's also Poles in Ukraine, there's Romanians. I don't know so much about what's happening now, but I know that over the last 8 years, there have been actions against those populations as well. So I'm sure there are some genuine right wingers among the Ukrainian nationalists who don't have these ethnic chauvinist feelings, but I don't know that that makes a difference, because their government definitely is, and they've proven it again and again through their actions. There's a very good documentary about the Hungarian minority in Ukraine since 2014. I can provide the link for if anyone's interested. But anyway, I just thought that was important to get out there.
Okay. Here's one other question. What do you make of people suggesting that if Ukraine is successful? Oh, no, I've already asked that. This might sound crazy, but what do you think of the idea that the war is about financial debt that Ukraine owed to international mega banks, and that Ukraine is using some of the aid it's getting to pay off this debt? Seems unlikely, but do you have anything to say about
that? I've heard this theory, but I don't know enough about it. I mean, I know that the Ukrainian government was virtually bankrupt when the war started. And now, of course, they're going even further into debt. But I think that this is just more ways for the West to get its hooks into them. I don't think that this is... I mean, maybe they're using it to pay, but I've got to believe that right now their creditors are probably just saying, well, let's wait till the war is finished. But I don't know. Economics is not my field, so I can't really make any definite statements about that.
Okay. Here's a question about Hungary. Does Hungary have a tradition of lost lands like Germany? If so, does it look likely that Orbán may make territorial demands on its neighbors, given the shrinking after 1918?
Yeah, that's a good question. I knew nothing about it till I came here, but everyone knows the Treaty of Versailles, of course, but what's less known is that in 1920, there was a separate treaty for Hungary called the Treaty of Trianon that was signed in June of 1920. And in that treaty, Hungary lost about 70% of its territory. So it was much, much more than the Germans lost. The biggest chunk was Transylvania. They also lost, they had parts of, well, all of Slovakia and all of Croatia, Subcarpathia that I mentioned, that's now in Ukraine. Part went to Serbia, a tiny piece went to Austria. Basically, every country around Hungary got a chunk of it. and in many cases, I think it's between 3 and 4 million Hungarians still live in those areas. And how they're treated varies from country to country. Like Serbia has done very well with its Hungarian minority, for example, whereas Romania has not, but that's a whole nother topic. But you definitely hear about this from Hungarians. They refer to the old Hungary as Nagy Magyarország, or Great Greater Hungary. You do meet people like more of the football hooligan types who talk about, you know, invading and taking back these territories. I don't think many Hungarians really have that sentiment, though. I mean, they want to see that the Hungarian minorities in those countries are looked after and that they're treated fairly, that they're allowed to speak their language and retain their culture and so forth. But first of all, I don't think Hungarians have an appetite for more war. I mean, they were devastated three times in the 20th century, in the First World War, the Second, and also in the 1956 revolution. Wars have never worked out well for Hungary, so I don't think they really want to get involved in that. The other thing is that their military, last I checked, I think they have 30,000 troops. That's really not much. I mean, that's not really an invasion force. So they don't even really have the means to do it. But beyond that, Orban and his political party, which is called Fidesz, they've never really been revanchist. You know, they've never been the types to demand getting territory back. I mean, they do make efforts to protect the rights of Hungarians in the surrounding countries, the Hungarian minorities. But there's never been any talk from Fidesz about actually reconquering territory. That there was recently a row because Orban was at a football match in Italy, I think it was. And he was photographed wearing a scarf that had the map of Nagy Magyarország, of Greater Hungary, on it. And the Romanians were really pissed. And the Ukrainians, I think, actually demanded a meeting with the Hungarian ambassador because of this, because they thought it was like a subtle message from
a dog whistle.
I think he probably just did it as a joke, because Orban has a very good sense of humor. I don't think I think in a sense he may have been needling the Ukrainians a little bit, because they've had a lot of disagreements this year. Hungarians don't tend to be very crazy about Ukraine, I have to say. They're not crazy about Russia either, let me make it clear. But they also don't really like the Ukrainians. So I think maybe he was needling them a little bit because, you know, the Russians were circulating these rumors that Hungary and Poland were drawing up plans to attack Ukraine from the other side and take back their lost territories. I don't believe that. I think maybe Orban is playing with that idea.
Yeah, that doesn't sound likely. Are there any details on the death of Daria Dugina, or is it likely that we'll never know the identity of her killers?
Well, I'm glad somebody asked that, because that was something I wanted to bring up. I mean, that was very personal for me, because I actually knew her. I never met her personally, but we corresponded for years. And of course, I know her father, who I actually have met, and I've worked with him off and on since the 1990s, actually. I'm not myself part of his movement, but I find him a very interesting thinker, and I've done work to try to help propagate his ideas. But I remember that evening, a friend of mine sent me a message saying that she'd been killed in a car bomb. And I that was so absurd to me that I just wrote back to him and said, that's not funny. You shouldn't make jokes like that. Over the course of the evening, I realized it was actually true. And I still can't believe that they would think that either Dari or her father were worthwhile targets. I mean, neither one of them are politicians or military. I mean, all I can think is that it was sort of like a mafia-like warning or something, because they were both, of course, very in favor of the Russian war effort. But as for the killers, I mean, there's never been any serious doubt in my mind that it was somebody in Ukraine. I don't think it was necessarily Zelensky who pushed the button or whatever. There's certainly many factions there now who all have a lot of weapons, a lot of money and training. So there's probably many possible culprits. Some people suggested it might be rivals within Russia. But for me, that possibility was put to rest when the CIA, I think it was, or somebody in Washington came out a couple of months later and actually castigated Ukraine for having assassinated her. I don't think they would have done that unless they had some pretty definite intel. And I think their motive for doing that would be they want to make sure that Ukraine doesn't go off the plan. They want to make sure that Ukraine's under control. So I sort of saw that as Washington's way of warning them, like, you know, don't get too crazy.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I agree.
I don't know as to whether we'll actually know the actual people who did it. I doubt that, at least not with any certainty. But the Russians have proposed their own perpetrators, but I don't know what to make of that. So, but yeah, that was quite shocking for me, I have to say. It's still unbelievable to me that it happened. She was just 29 years old.
Yeah, yeah. There was a certain amount of ghoulishness about it, people celebrating and so on. I find that very distasteful.
I feel the same way about people who celebrate. Some people post jokes about Ukrainians being killed. I find that disgusting as well. So yeah, for me, it's both.
Yes, I agree. I mean, you know, unless you have some personal reason to feel animus against these people, then, you know, why take pleasure in their deaths? I mean, it just seems sick.
I agree.
Okay, but moving on from that, there was another one that I wanted to ask. Azov, along with many other battalions, are legit. There is no second revolution because of the war. That's an opinion there. Newland, Blinken, this is from Joey. Newland, Blinken, and many more are embittered Ukrainian Jews themselves. Yeah, that's what I was alluding to earlier. It's alarming how many Ukrainian Jews there are in America. Right. It's not something you really hear about until it suddenly becomes relevant with this war. Darby says,
Jews and the foreign policy establishment in the U.S. have never been a good thing.
Darby says, very good point by John, regardless of who wins in Ukraine. Europe comes out of this weaker as a result, meaning it's a major win for the U.S. Yeah, I think that's... it's clear and it's depressing. You know, you tend to think, as a naive Westerner, you tend to think that we're all in this together. It's all the West. It's all one thing. There's a lot of interplay and exchange between America and Europe. But actually, there is a divide, and America will fuck over Europe in order to better its own chances.
Oh, of course. I mean, America... Well, I think all politics... is sociopathic. I'm not saying necessarily all politicians are. I suspect many of them are. But nations only do things in their own self-interest. No nation does things out of altruism. So, I mean, that's one thing I actually respect Dugin for in his commentaries, because he never plays the sympathy card. Like, he never says, oh, look at how horrible the U.S. is, these horrible injustices it's inflicting on Russia and Europe and so forth. He'll actually say, no, this, of course they do this because this is their power interests. Well, we have our power interests and we fight for those. That's how you have to look at politics. It's not about feelings or about affection. It's that's why I'm very glad I'm not in politics, because I'm not that kind of a person. But I think you have to be very cold-blooded to even understand it.
Yes, yes, and I'm the same. I agree. I would be. I've always thought I would be dreadful in politics.
I never had any
reason. Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been a really interesting talk. Is there anything else that you would like to say about Ukraine before we wrap up?
No, I could go on, but I think I've made all the major points, and I imagine people are probably tired of hearing about it by now. So is there anything else you wanted to cover?
No, I want to keep it fairly concise because I've got to get the next person on in 25 minutes. So I'll need a wee break in between. But this has been a good one. I like to keep it fairly focused because I think it means that what you end up with is each stream is about a particular thing, and it sort of serves that purpose. For example, I'm going to have another one on with Horace. He'll be talking about the FTX debacle. So I think, you know, it means that each stream is kind of useful in and of itself, as hopefully at least that's the goal. And all right, I think there aren't any more super chats. So let me just check that. Yep. Okay. So, well, we'll be back in half an hour or 25 minutes with Jay Burden. But in the meantime, John Morgan, thank you for taking part in Millennial 8.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Well, not, it's a grim topic, obviously, but it's been an enjoyable conversation.
it was constructive. It was positive.
Yes. I think so. All right. I'll see you all in a wee while. Bye-bye for now.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The show must go on, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile blogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the show and spread the word.